First, a brief announcement.
Primeiramente, somente anúncio, bem rápido.
We promised a visual aid for the Four Noble Truths and all the other mathematics.
Nós prometemos uma ajuda visual para as quatro nobres verdades.
It is now up on the whiteboard outside.
Então está lá fora, postado no no quadro branco lá fora.
I hope it clears up some confusion.
Espero que possa clarificar algumas dúvidas.
Okay, for tonight's talk. We talked today about how the Buddha was characterized by his wisdom, compassion, and purity.
Falamos hoje à tarde como Buda é caracterizado pela sabedoria, pela compaixão e pela pureza.
And we can see these qualities being developed in the Noble Eightfold Path.
Podemos ver essas qualidades sendo desenvolvidas no Nobre Caminho Octuplo.
Right view is practice in wisdom.
A perspectiva correta é a prática na sabedoria.
Right resolve is practice in compassion.
A resolução correta é a prática da compaixão.
And the remaining factors are all practice in purity.
E os outros fatores restantes são fatores.
All the remaining ones.
São os fatores restantes do caminho octuplo.
In other words, we take our good intentions, our wise intentions, and we actually try to embody them in our actions.
Ou seja, tomamos as nossas ações e tentamos as nossas intenções, nossas Só tomamos as nossas ações hábeis e tentamos torná-las, agir nessas ações.
Okay. This is very, very clear in the three factors we're going to be talking about tonight.
Isso está bem claro nos fatores que vamos falar hoje à noite, nos três fatores.
Right speech, right action, right livelihood.
A fala correta, a ação correta e o modo de vida correto.
These three come under the heading of virtue.
Esses três, eles estão sob o título da virtude.
And they show that the practice is not just a matter of theory or of meditation techniques.
E eles mostram que a prática não é somente algo teórico, mas é algo que se põe em ação, algo que você age sobre essas coisas.
But also in the integrity of your actions as they have an impact on other people.
Então é algo que fala sobre integridade. Integridade é algo que você quer relativo às outras, como você age com as outras pessoas.
This practice in integrity then helps to further your actual understanding and your ability to train the mind in deeper ways.
Então, essa prática da integridade com as outras pessoas, ela faz com que você aumente o seu entendimento ao passo que você está lidando com as outras pessoas.
And the lessons that you learn as you develop right speech, right action, and livelihood will be applicable as you develop your meditation.
E essas lições que você aprende da ação correta, do modo de vida correta, da fala correta, elas serão úteis para você aplicar também na meditação.
So let's take the factors one by one.
Então vamos tomar os fatores um por um.
Okay. The first one is right speech.
O primeiro é a fala correta.
Okay. This basically comes down to four things. Okay. Refraining from telling lies, refraining from speaking divisively, and refraining from speaking harshly, and refraining from engaging in idle chatter. In each case, the type of wrong speech you're avoiding is defined by its intention. When you tell a lie, you are trying to misrepresent the truth. When you speak divisively, you're trying to get friends to break apart from one another. Or if you see that a friendship is developing and you feel threatened by it, you try to prevent the friendship by telling one side things that the other side has done that will make that person look bad. Speaking harshly is when you intend simply to hurt other people's feelings and you have no other intention at all. You just want to say something that makes them feel bad. And finally, idle chatter is the kind of talk that really doesn't have any clear intention at all. You just open your mouth and whatever comes out without you really thinking about it. So when you engage in right speech, you're actually gaining training in your intentions. You want your speech to be truthful. You want your speech to be harmonious. You want your speech to go easily down people's ears. And finally, you want to speak in a way that you really have a purpose in your speaking. Now, as we mentioned earlier today, idle chatter is the one that's hardest often for us to hold to, because idle chatter is a part of our social life. But as I said, if you actually engage in it, with a purpose, i.e. purpose of making society, your social society, get together, get along better, okay, then that's fine. It's simply when you forget about the intention and just start saying anything that comes into your head, that's when idle chatter becomes wrong speech. Out of these four types of wrong speech, there's only one that's related to a precept, and that's the precept against telling lies, which means that it admits no exceptions. The Buddha doesn't make any exception for telling a lie where you think he would protect somebody, telling a lie which you think is a white lie, as we say in English. The kind of little kinds of lies that we say, that many of us say that it's okay. The Buddha says, really, no, there's no exception here. When you open your mouth and you say something, you want your speech to be a representation of the truth. Now, what this means in practice is that there are times when you might be speaking to someone and you're afraid that if you give them information that they might misuse, they might harm somebody else with it. It is okay not to give that information, but you can't misrepresent the truth. What this means is you have to be careful in how you phrase what you say, how you avoid certain topics. Sometimes you may have to change the topic of conversation in order to keep yourself from having to misrepresent the truth. But here, basically in terms of right speech, there are no exceptions for telling lies. Now, in the case of speaking divisively, if you see that two people are becoming friends and you are afraid that one person will start abusing the other, it is okay to warn the other one about this possible abuse. Similarly, when you're speaking to someone and you speak sweetly to them and they don't listen, sometimes you have to engage in harsh chatter, harsh speech. So there are cases where your intention will make a difference as to whether what would qualify as divisive speech or harsh speech or idle chatter would be wrong speech or would be right speech. But specifically with telling lies, there are no exceptions. The Buddha's own general rule for his own speech was that he would say things that were true, beneficial, and timely. Now, some things that might be true, but if they're not beneficial, he would not say them. Or if they were true and beneficial, but then you would have to look at the right time. When is the time to say something pleasant? When is the time to say something unpleasant? The Buddha would say things that would be unpleasant sometimes. There's the case with Devadatta. Devadatta was trying to cause a split in the Sangha. And no matter how much the Buddha talked to him, Devadatta wouldn't listen to him. So finally the Buddha realized that Devadatta was a lost case. And so in front of a lot of other people, he called him a lickspittle, which is an old insult. Basically what it means, it's the type of person who, when someone else spits something out on the ground, you lick it up. It's a very harsh term. And so, some months later, the Buddha was called on this. Why would he use harsh speech like this? And he said the way he would speak was like a parent whose child has got something sharp in its mouth. You hold the child carefully, and you put your finger in the child's mouth, and you get that sharp object out, even if it means drawing blood, because you're afraid that if the child swallows it, even worse things will happen. So there are times when the Buddha would say things that would be very unpleasant in hopes that it would warn the person that the person was going off course, or at least warn other people around that person that the person was going off course and should not be followed. So instead of, sometimes I get the impression that Buddha would say things that are only sweetness and light, but there are times when he actually would see that it was the time to say something that would be unpleasant, but he would know the proper time and the proper place for that. So those are the general rules in the Buddha's own speech, that he would speak things that are true, beneficial, and he would look for the right time to say pleasant things, the right time to say unpleasant things. So those are the general principles of right speech. Right action refers to three things: refraining from killing, refraining from stealing, and refraining from illicit sex. All of these are precepts, which means that they should be followed without any exception. Now, this means, in practical terms, that you have to be very careful about how you arrange your house, how you arrange your life, for example, so that you don't have to kill little insects and little pests that come into the house. In other words, you don't wait for them to come in and then kill them. You try to prevent them from coming in to begin with. It also means that you have to learn how to deal with ants and other things without killing them and yet not let them invade your space. And there are various techniques that you can develop so that you can keep your house safe from the pests without having to kill them. Refraining from stealing, is probably the easiest of the bunch. And then there's refraining from illicit sex. Now, what this means is, if you are married, you don't have sex with someone and anyone besides your spouse. As for people who are not married, it means that you don't have sex with people who already are married. You don't have sex with minors. You don't have sex with those who have taken a vow of celibacy. So the only difficulty in adhering to right action in these cases is most particularly in the refraining from killing. We had the example today of someone threatens you, and as the Buddha said, it's okay to fight back, but you don't fight back with the intention to kill. So you have to learn how to reorder your life in such a way that you can maintain your safety without having to kill any other living beings. And this requires a lot of care on your part, but that taking care in how you live your life is a useful exercise in mindfulness, preparing you for your practice of concentration and discernment. Right livelihood is the factor that is of the path that is the vaguest definition. In the standard definition, it just says simply that you avoid wrong livelihood, but it doesn't say what wrong livelihood is. We have to look at other spots in the canon to see what occupations the Buddha might have criticized. There's one passage where he says that you would avoid selling weapons, selling living beings, in other words, animals that were meant to be used as food, or selling slaves, selling meat, selling intoxicants, or selling poison. The general criteria that he uses is you would also avoid occupations that entail giving rise to anger in yourself, greed or aversion, and delusion in others. The examples we find in the canon are of soldiers who die in battle while they're trying to kill somebody else. That's the wrong occupation. Actors who try to give rise to passion, aversion, and delusion in their audience. That also counts as a wrong occupation. It's interesting in these cases, though, that when in both of these cases, a soldier comes to see the Buddha and says, our teacher says that I will go to heaven because of my occupation. What does the Buddha have to say? And the Buddha refused to answer at first. And the tradition in those days was that if someone asked a question three times, that was a sign that they were sincere, and then you were committed to answer. And so the soldier asked him three times, no, I really want to know what the Buddha has to think about this. And the Buddha says, if you in the midst of the battle, and you're hoping, may these beings die, may these beings come to destruction, and you're killed at that moment, instead of going to heaven, you're going to go to hell. The soldier breaks down into tears. And the Buddha says, this is why I didn't want to answer your question. And the Buddha says, the soldier says, no, I'm not crying because of what you said, I'm crying because my teachers lied to me. Similarly with the actor. The actor comes and sees the Buddha. What does the Buddha think of his occupation? He says his teachers told him that through his acting, he was going to be reborn in the heaven of laughter. And the Buddha says, please don't ask me that. And so again, the actor asks him three times, and the Buddha finally says, okay, if you're up there trying to give rise to greed, aversion, and delusion in your audience, and you yourself are giving rise to passion, aversion, and delusion in your own mind, then when you die, you'll go to the hell of laughter, which is very different from the heaven of laughter. Instead of people laughing with you, they're laughing at you. What's interesting here is the Buddha didn't go out and say, your occupation is bad, to other people. He waited until they came and they asked sincerely to want to know what his opinion was. So the Buddha didn't have a campaign about wiping out certain occupations. This is something simply that people would voluntarily come and want to know, is their occupation something that will be helpful or not helpful on the path? Finally, there's the kind of occupation where the occupation itself is honest, but you figure out some dishonest way of doing it. And here again, there's an example. Sariputta is talking to one of his students, and the student has become a corrupt government official. And basically explains himself, well, I have to do this for the sake of feeding my wife and my children and my parents. And the Buddha says, you know, if you die and the hell guardians are about to throw you into hell, and you say, no, please, please, what I was doing was because I was helping my wife and children and parents, would they listen to you and not give you punishment, or would they throw you into hell just as you were complaining? And the man has to admit, well, they would throw me into hell while I was complaining. So simply because you say, I need to feed these people, I have to give my livelihood in a dishonest or harmful way, that is not an excuse. There are harmless occupations out there. There was a cartoon in the New York Yorker magazine in America, showed two guys walking down a wharf carrying a corpse with its feet in concrete. They were about to throw the corpse off the wharf into the river. And one of them was saying, I wish there were another way to make a living. Of course, there are many other ways to make a living. You have to use your imagination. The important principle about right livelihood is that sometimes by following right livelihood, you may have to do with less. You see other people making money out of being dishonest, and you say, well, no, I don't want to do that. I have to be content with not having the material possessions that they have. For monks, this requires reflection on the requisites, contentment with what you've got, and realizing all the suffering that goes into excessive consumption. For lay people, however, the Buddha didn't say, well, just make a meager living and be happy with that. He says you could have initiative in making a skillful living, engaging in right occupation, and you can become as industrious as you want in order to give rise to wealth. Wealth itself is not a bad thing. The important thing is that you gain it in a skillful way. Once you've gained your wealth, then you guard your gains. You don't use them carelessly, and you don't let them go to waste. And finally, you try to make good use of your wealth, not only for your own pleasure and the pleasure of your family right now, but as an investment in your future, i.e. looking for ways of being generous and helpful to other people so that your wealth then becomes a source of good karma for leading from this life into the next. Now, the guidance that these factors gain from right view is an understanding in terms of karma, what it means to harm yourself and what it means to harm others. The Buddha has an interesting passage where he says that by breaking the precepts, by killing, stealing, lying, you harm yourself. To harm other people is when you get them to do these things. In other words, other people are not simply the recipients of your actions. They, too, are agents. And you can actually harm them worse by getting them to behave in an unskillful way. That does much more serious harm to them than simply your killing or stealing them. You get them to kill, get them to steal. That actually harms them in a very long-term way. There's also a concept that the Buddha teaches, he calls not fashioning, in which you try to do good and yet you don't disparage other people for not being as good as you are. And this begins with the precepts. Remember, you're taking the precepts basically as a way of looking after yourself, and you don't look down on other people because they are not observing the precepts. If you exalt yourself and disparage other people, again, you're doing harm to yourself. So it's important to keep this principle in mind as you practice the precepts. You're not doing it to be better than others or to show off to other people. You're doing it because you need the good karma that comes from following the precepts. At the same time, in addition to learning lessons from right view and right resolve, these practices of right speech, right action, and right livelihood give you extra discernment that makes these forms of wisdom even stronger. In the case of the categories that do not allow for exception, which are the precepts, you have to exercise your discernment in knowing how to follow them and yet at the same time not cause harm. In other words, knowing when not to disclose harmful information while at the same time not lying. This requires a lot of skill, and that skill that you develop then becomes your improved discernment. In the cases that do allow for exceptions, as we mentioned, with divisive speech or with harsh speech, you have to know when to trust your reasoning for engaging these kind of speech, because it is so easy for the mind to lie to itself. But when you get better and better at gauging when your reasoning or your intentions are good, okay, that gives you improved discernment into your own mind. At the same time, as you follow these precepts, they exercise the qualities needed for mindfulness practice. The mindfulness itself in learning to keep the precept in mind at all times. Alertness in noticing what you're doing so that you're not breaking the precept. And finally, ardency in doing what you can to figure out how not to break the precept. These are the three qualities that then get used in mindfulness practice, and then, of course, from mindfulness, go on into concentration practice. At the same time, those three questions with right speech that you ask yourself, is this true? If it's true, is it beneficial? If it's true and beneficial, is this the right time to say this or not? These three questions can also be applied to the verbal fabrications going on in your mind while you're practicing concentration. In other words, a thought comes up, that might distract you, and you ask yourself, is this thought true or is it just make-believe? If it's not true, why bother? If it's true, then the next question is, would it be beneficial to follow this? And if it's beneficial, is this the right time and place to follow this line of thinking? Because some thinking actually is useful during the concentration and others is not. And as you get practical, you get practice and figure out which kind of verbal fabrications meet this test and which ones don't, then it improves your discernment. So you start out with right speech on the external level, and that gives you practice in developing right speech inside the mind. Then, of course, there's just the simple fact that virtue is what allows concentration to develop in the mind, to yield the fruit of genuine discernment, because it's a concentration that's based on honesty and lack of remorse. There's no need for denial. When you sit down to meditate and something comes up in your mind of how you harmed yourself or harmed other people, it's very difficult for the mind to settle down. Now, sometimes you can get into denial and just say, well, I didn't really do any wrong. But then the concentration that develops from that is not going to be good for your discernment. It's going to be a dishonest concentration, which can actually lead you astray. So if you learn how to be honest and harmless in your actions, it's a lot easier for your concentration to be open to developing true discernment. And practicing, finally, of non-fashioning on the level of the precepts, in other words, not building up a sense of self around the precepts, but simply practice them because they're good for you, will also be good for your concentration. Because as the Buddha said, if you develop a pride around your concentration, my jhana is better than your jhana, that kind of attitude actually destroys your concentration, destroys your insight. So the practice that comes from learning how not to exalt yourself around the precepts then carries over into learning how not to exalt yourself around the practice of meditation. And in this way, the integrity that's developed by right speech, right action, right livelihood, then adds to the integrity of your practice of mindfulness and concentration.